So the people that were doing something while they were eating and they weren't just sitting with their food and eating weighed 18% more than the people that weren't doing something while they were eating. And so 18% more, what the heck does that mean? It feels very, you know, just an idea. 150-pound person, it's 27 extra pounds. Mm-hmm. Significant.
Got it.
It's very significant.
Hi, everyone. Drew Pruitt here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. On today's interview, we have Dr. Mary Perdee, who is a regular on our podcast, and she's a naturopathic and functional medicine doctor, and we've invited her here to talk about a whole host of subjects, including why working on your emotional and spiritual health is one of the greatest return on investments you could ever make for your overall wellness. Number two, we talk about how does she talk about the vaccine with her patients and help them decide if the vaccine is right for them when it comes to COVID-19. A lot of people from our community asking about that question. Should I get the vaccine? Who needs to be a little bit more cautious and work with a doctor when getting the vaccine? And more specifically, we break down gut health. Mary specializes in gastroenterology, functional gastroenterology, and we talk to her about her top tips when it comes to gut health. Cheap, easy tips and tricks that you can add in without spending a lot of money to improve your gut health today. It's a fascinating interview. Stay tuned. Today's sponsor is Thrive Market. I know everyone is trying to stay healthy at home. It's a new year, trying to put that intention on all our future goals and intentions, especially health being up there. So I want to recommend a favorite resource that I use to get healthy food delivered right to my doorstep, and it's Thrive Market. I've been recommending them since 2015. See, the thing is, when it comes to what I eat, I'm really intentional. It's super important to me to know exactly what I'm buying so I can take a deep dive into the ingredients and the companies and the practices they have before adding anything new to my kitchen. With Thrive Market, I've been able to find tons of the brands I trust in one spot, like Four Sigmatic, started by my good friend Taro Isacopola, Hugh Kitchen, which I'm an investor of, love the company, Artisana, and so many others for 25 to 50% off of traditional retail prices. You can choose from a 1 month or 12 month membership to take advantage of their amazing deals. And if you're not into it, you have 30 days to cancel. Thrive Market has thousands of products, including gluten-free, dairy-free, certified organic, paleo, fair trade, vegan. They just added a new vegan filter that's going to be launching soon. You can find something for every kind of diet. You can get all the healthy ingredients and kitchen essentials you need, and even clean home and body care products. Don't use the toxic stuff. Switch over to the clean stuff. Thrive Market has it. They also have things like wild-caught, sustainable seafood options, grass-fed beef. It's super easy to plan ahead for healthy meals and get it all delivered right to your doorstep. It's convenience. And right now, Thrive Market is offering all Broken Brain podcast listeners a great, great deal. You'll get a bonus 25% off your first purchase plus a free gift when you become a Thrive Market member. Again, they have a 1 month and a 12 month membership. Anytime you spend more than $49, you'll get a free carbon neutral shipping. Just head over to thrivemarket.com/broken brain. That's thrivemarket.com/broken brain. Sign up today. You won't regret it. Mary, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
For folks that didn't hear our first conversation, we'll be linking to all that in the show notes. We did a really good interview with you that a lot of people really appreciated, which was if you would do a modern day physical, if you were going to go through a modern day physical, what are the additional tests? And also, what are the optimal numbers that you want to be hitting when it comes to vitamin D or like omega-3 to omega-6 ratio? Telomeres, like you basically walked people through a modern day physical. It was pretty in depth. I think it was like a 2-hour interview. People really loved it. And so they can check that out in the show notes. That was a really fun one. This one is going to be a little bit different. We have a whole host of topics we want to get into. Vaccines. I want to hear your perspective as a functional medicine and naturopathic doctor. We're going to chat a little about gut health and a few other topics to come up. So I'm excited to get into it.
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Before we jump into the topic of vaccines, I want to ask you, we're in LA. You live in Los Angeles. I live in Los Angeles. And it's been, California has been one of the most strict sort of lockdowns, although now things are starting to ease back up. You couldn't even do outdoor dining before, but now that's kind of easing up a little bit. How has the last year, like 2020, how is that for you from like a social interaction standpoint? You, at least as far as I know, you live alone at the moment.
Yep.
So how is that for you? And I'm asking you because I know that in addition to functional medicine, naturopathic medicine, you're super into this whole aspect of mental health. And I think that mental health has been one of the things that we have not balanced out the repercussions of strict lockdowns. Love California, but that's definitely been one of the places. How has been the last, how was 2020 for you from a social standpoint and mental health standpoint?
Yeah, I think this is a great topic. I was talking to Omid, our mutual friend.
Yeah, Dr. Omid Naeem.
Yep, and he's been on the podcast as well. But just yesterday, we had this conversation. And we were talking about how, you know, we've had a lot of deaths from COVID. And that's something that we need to focus on for sure. But I think that there's a little bit of an exchange that's happening where we're not realizing the impact of mental health and the deaths that are going to come from that aspect of it. So we were talking about relapses of addiction that are happening right now, right? And we're seeing people relapse at much higher rates because of social isolation, most probably. They don't have people to reach out to. They don't have places to go in person and have that contact. And so I think it is something that we're not really looking at as closely as we should be. For me personally, it was a tough year for sure. Living by yourself, not being married, you know, being single in an apartment by yourself without roommates, it's a whole different thing. And for me personally, I had a small group of friends where I said, I'm going to see these people still. And I think that you have to do something like that for your mental health. If you don't have family that are local or you don't have a significant other or a roommate that you live with, you have to kind of make your family. And so that's how I went about it. And I don't know how I would have done it differently, because I think you do full solitude isolation, then that can be really scary for somebody.
Totally. Was there any things that you tapped into, any new rituals or things that you were doing that you hadn't really done as much of in the past?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a big year of tapping into my spirituality. I would say the last 12 months, I did more like soul searching and digging than I've ever done in my life. And I've heard that being a common theme for other people too, really figuring out like what is important to me was a big part of 2020. There's a lot of time to do that. There's a lot of quiet time. There wasn't as much travel for me either. So I was kind of grounded in LA and had the time to do that soul searching. But yeah, getting in touch with spirituality and figuring out like what is my true authentic self, like what do I want for myself, was really significant for me this past year.
That's powerful. Any books top level on the topic, and I'm sure we'll come back to spirituality, anything that you read or anybody's work or influence last year that in that area of spirituality had a significant impact on you?
Yeah, you just had him on the podcast, Gabor Mate.
Yep.
So I've read a bunch of his books, but he was a big one. Waking the Tiger is a book about trauma.
Yeah.
That's a big one. What are my other ones? There was one more about something surrender in, it's about trauma. It was about like how to relate to trauma. I'll think of the name at some point.
It's crazy. Like the more that you learn and the more that I feel like a lot of people get into this world in sort of functional medicine, naturopathic medicine, which you're also trained in, you know, you start, it's natural. You start at sort of the obvious stuff. Mm-hmm. You started the food, you started the fitness. Then it kind of gets into a little bit of sort of maybe some of the deeper aspects of that, some of the chronic conditions that are there, you become more aware of like air and mold and, you know, all that stuff. And ultimately, I think that when you have a good grasp on those basics, it really then just goes full circle back to just pure like emotional and mental health. And that being one of the strongest factors, piggybacking off of our interview with Gabor Mate, you could be doing everything else, but if that is still not fully looked at, especially how your early childhood experiences shaped you as a human being, you tend to play out a lot of the same patterns and you tend to still deal with a lot of the same issues.
100%. And I mean, that's my story too, right? Like I've gone all into gut health. I've gone all into, you know, the biohacking stuff, like mold and all of these heavy metals, like everything. But when you see people continually come back to your practice and they're not getting better, you realize that sometimes there's this piece missing of this emotional, mental health, spirituality piece that's like, okay, this is probably the last little block that we're missing out of the whole pie.
The last little block, but could be like the most influential block.
Most influential. And a lot of the time it is. And I think sometimes it takes people longer to realize that that's something that they want to go into themselves. And so sometimes they have to deal with more of the physical things first, you know, blood sugar regulation or micronutrient deficiencies. And then when they're ready to actually say, okay, I'm ready to talk about my childhood. I'm ready to talk about what happened with my mom when I was 12 or something like that. And that's when you see the most dramatic healing in my mind. It's not that everybody needs that piece. I would say 99.9% of people do. And I think that that's when you see the biggest shift with people. But it does. It takes a certain level of readiness for them to say, okay, I'm ready to buy into this.
Yeah. I actually kind of think like not in the way that everybody needs it, like I'm dictating, but honestly, I think everybody needs it. I really think that that is, yeah. I have amazing parents. Like I love my parents and they are just really good parents in terms of how they operate. And my dad, especially, my mom had some stuff and I've been open on past podcasts of just one generation to another, right? She was doing the best she can. All parents are doing the best she can. All parents are doing the best that they can. And my mom was still great. And I had like such a great childhood. And even I still had stuff that's there. You know, Gabor Mate, we didn't talk about it a bunch, but he on his website, on the resources page, he links to Landmark Form. And for those that aren't familiar with Landmark Form, it's basically from this group called EST, which was very popular in the 60s. And it was this personal development process, which was combining different traditions, Buddhist and spiritual traditions and psychology and other stuff, to take people through an experience where they really get a chance to understand. It's an in-person workshop to really understand how their early childhood experiences impact them as human beings. And one of the ways that they do that is that they look at the things that you're good at. So take the things that say, oh, Drew is really good at this. So if you survey my friends and family and they say, what is Drew really good at? So they might say, Drew is like super kind. He always has everybody's back, right? It's what I often hear from my friends. He's always kind of checking in and looking after other people. Well, the tendency is the things in our life that we got good at came from some sort of pain.
Yeah.
And that's what Gabor Mate was talking about, not to overquote him, but that's what they also talk about in the Landmark Forum. And I found Landmark at a point in time in my life where I just kept on falling on my face when I was trying to start my first company after I dropped out of college. And a friend of mine said, he was actually a client of mine who I'd missed like tons of deadlines with. And he was like, look, I see you working hard and I see you wanting to be better, but I think you are shooting yourself in the foot. And if you can become more aware of your patterns and how they play out, I think you'll shoot yourself in the foot less often. Yeah. It's like that Instagram meme back in the day. They have like Scooby-Doo. I don't know all the characters' names, but one of the Scooby-Doo characters, and they see like a ghost with like a mask on. They're like, man, who is behind all my problems? And they take off the mask and it's just them.
Yeah.
Like it's a photo of them. So going back to Landmark, when I did it, one of the things that I got really clear on is that these things that I'm known for as an individual came from When I was young, my family moved around a lot. My dad got all these great opportunities. He was in healthcare and he was rising up the corporate ladder. So we moved from Kenya to Nashville, Tennessee, from Nashville to El Paso, Texas to Delaware. So I was always perpetually the new kid. And as the new kid, I would move in these sort of early age groups. All this happened before the age of 12. I would find myself with a different peer group some, for the first time in their community, was a brown person. Mm-hmm. You know, they knew what black people look like. They knew what white people look like. But this brown guy, like, who is he? What kind of food does their family eat? Like, it's different, right? Kids are crazy. They're like naturally going to pick on people who are different. And I remember having experiences where I was like, I feel like I have to fight so hard just to make a friend or be accepted, at least was the narrative that I was telling myself. And a few times got into what I deemed to be early conflict for being the new kid, like fights and other things like that. And through that process, realizing how something as simple as that of just a kid trying to explain to his parents, like, I don't like it here because I don't fit in with anybody. And then having to explain that again when you move to a new town and again, and now you're in a situation where you're like, shit, how do I adapt? How do I minimize the pain? Well, let me get good at making sure that I'm indispensable when it comes to other people. So I'm always going to be the person that has the best resources. I'm always going to be the person that has access to things, because if I have that, then it's less likelihood that I'm going to be left out or abandoned or other stuff.
Yeah.
And those are all beautiful things. And when I wasn't aware of it, I would go too far and I would do things for people that I didn't want to do. People pleasing. That's a natural thing that comes out of people who are good at fitting in and not wanting to be abandoned. There's the people pleasing side. There's the other side of, like, you don't honor boundaries. If your plate is full, you say yes to more stuff because saying no goes against your identity that you orchestrated. So that was something major that I got out of Landmark. I always tell people, like, I loved my experience at Landmark. I have my own challenges with sometimes how they market and some of their languaging and other stuff. It's a little bit salesy, but I genuinely benefited from that experience. And when you were talking about childhood and connecting it to who we are today, I wanted to share that because I have not really gone into depth with that with the audience before. And I think it's useful for people to see, like, I had a great childhood. Like, what are you talking about? I don't know if I need to do inner work. And I think that everybody could benefit from inner work.
100%. And I think that's what I mean too by, like, finding your authentic self. It's like figuring out what your story was, like you putting together that story of how you were affected with what happened in childhood and why you are the way you are today. I think that's a really valuable journey that if you fully understand your own journey, you can more appreciate your younger self, but also appreciate and have gratitude for who you are today. And so for me, it was perfectionism. And that's like,
tell me more. Do you want to share about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think at a really young age, I learned that I would get attention from things that were more perfectionist. So maybe it was not eating my whole meal. And then my mom would tell me, you got to finish your meal. But there was a tension that came there. And it eventually developed into a full eating disorder in high school. But there was some power and control behind that too. And I think that I liked that control, whether it was controlling my food intake or controlling, you know, the eventual business that I would build. But I think it started from this inherent and very natural tendency of just wanting attention as a young girl. And so I see these patterns now throughout my life where it be perfectionist to the point of wanting to control things and also just controlling my own life. So I've had a lot of visuals over the last year of just like having, like, you know, straps, like feeling like I'm controlling myself almost to a point of being feeling like there's a cage around me. And I've heard this from other people too, where, you know, if you have this tendency of perfectionism, a lot of it is you're putting it onto yourself, right?
And just to ask a quick question on that, because I'm super curious. Do you think that, you know, you've used the word control a few times.
Yeah.
Did you feel when you were younger that things were out of control in some way?
I don't think that it was, for me, it was that I think I thought my family dynamic in terms of my parents worked so hard.
They had a restaurant, right?
They had a restaurant. Yeah, right. They were entrepreneurs.
24/7 a restaurant.
24/7. I mean, my dad worked from beginning of the morning. He'd come home at 2 a.m. My mom worked double. She worked as a nurse and then would go to the restaurant to hostess and help out. So they were incredibly hard workers. But I think inherently that gave me a sense of they have to work for money. So there was a sense of scarcity that I didn't have control over as a child because I couldn't make the money. So I think that there was this lack of control that I didn't know how to help, or I didn't want to be a burden when it came to finances and money. And so I only figured out how to control the things that I could control on my own. So I think that that's where a lot of it started to come from. But it's the same thing with you. Like, we had like the perfect nuclear family. Everybody was happy. Mom and dad are still married. They're loving. I have the most amazing parents on the planet. Totally. So there's nothing that they did wrong. They did everything right. In fact, they did it so right. They wanted to be able to provide vacations for us and travel. So they worked really hard for it. And so I think it is important for everybody to go and check it out, because it doesn't mean that you had to be abused or you had to be neglected as a child to have any sort of, you know, mental health things that you could benefit from.
It's more like this is just the human, it's the human dynamic. It's the hero's journey that everybody goes through, and it's a big part of what makes us human beings. And when I say my parents are perfect, and I know you mean the same thing, it's like to not also put them on a pedestal, right? They have their own stuff just like everybody has. But I think that people relate to that when they get shared, because sometimes you hear stories of people who've gone through, you know, crazy big T traumas.
Yeah.
And you're like, I haven't gone through that that I know, but almost all of us have gone through these little T traumas. And sometimes people have gone through big T traumas, but they've forgotten.
Yeah.
And especially in the space of mental health and other stuff, it's been just pushed down. So yeah, inner work, I would say, The three biggest things in terms of return on investment for me exploring them when it comes to my overall joy and happiness and who I am as a human being, I would say that the in the top three, I won't put them in order, even in top five, I would definitely put my experience with Landmark Forum. And I know that with the pandemic and not getting groups together in person, I know it's a little bit more difficult to do that now with them, but I think they have some online trainings and stuff. And I'll share exactly what my mentor shared, which is do it and enjoy the experience and get what you get out of it. And also know that they're an organization just like anybody else. They have their own marketing tactics, other stuff. They're a little bit kind of put heavy pressure on people to recommend the course to other people and to have you kind of go to the next thing. But I see the humanity in that, that they're just, you know, they're just trying to figure out their shit just like everybody else.
Yeah.
The next thing that made a huge difference in my life in the category of spirituality, where I was talking to you, and that was a big part of your last year, was the work of Eckhart Tolle has massively made a difference in my life. I can remember going through a really tough time in my life where I was given the book, The Power of Now.
Yeah.
And for the first time, I always knew intellectually that there's only the present moment exists, but I didn't feel it in my body. And when I read his works and I really sat there, right place, right time, right teachings, I immediately after reading that book had probably about 20% less thoughts, just on my average. I had like a moment of awakening because I was going through so much pain. I'm not saying that everybody's going to go through that. It was very much, I was going through a lot of suffering in my life at that time, a lot of expectations, a lot of living in the past, a lot of projecting into the future. I was very rarely in the present moment with my thoughts and how I felt. And that book significantly made a difference for me in that category. So childhood work, inner work, stepping back into the present moment, those things massively played a role in my development.
Yeah, I think we all have our things that like really, they, I think it's right time, right place too. Like had you read that book a different time in your life, maybe it wouldn't have been as impactful. But when you read the right thing at the right time, sometimes you can just be blown away by the changes that you can see.
Yeah. I think one thing, switching topics into some of the subjects that we wrote down that we want to get into, the other beautiful thing that all this inner work does is that it helps you see things for what they are and not get as easily triggered and be able to sit in the duality, which is life. You know, there the duality exists in so many things. In relationships, there's times where you love your partner and there's other times where you're like, I am going to, you don't actually feel this way, but you feel temporarily like, I want to strangle this person, or I want to, whatever it might be. Anybody in relationships has experienced both sides of that. It comes with kids. I don't have kids, but I have enough friends that have kids that know that you have those same feelings. It comes with politics, right? It comes with seeing both sides of stuff and seeing the truth is somewhere in the middle over there. And the truth is usually not how one extreme wants to look at stuff. And I can't think about a more divisive topic to open into, I hope you like the segue, of than the current thing that a lot of people are balancing out, especially in the health and wellness community, than vaccines. And I'd love to talk to you as a naturopathic doctor, as a functional medicine doctor who works with people all the time. I'm sure you're getting the question from patients of, should I get the vaccine? And usually when people are asking that question, I feel like they are most often coming in already maybe leaning in one direction or another, that this is all good, that this is all bad.
Yeah.
Or they're listening to other people that are out there instead of maybe just doing their own homework that they could be doing. So I'd love to get your thoughts on the topic of vaccines, because our community is very interested in it. How do you navigate and have conversation with your individual patients when they come to you and they say, should I be getting specifically, you know, like the coronavirus vaccine, COVID-19 vaccine?
Yeah. So for my patients, I think that we have an informed discussion between me and them about their health risks, like what where they're at. And that's different for every person based on their age, based on their comorbidities, based on, you know, whether they have an autoimmune condition. So it's very individualized, but we just have a conversation about it. And I really think that it should be an informed decision. It shouldn't be mandated. But I think that we need to make the decision for ourselves in the end. So with the vaccine, I'm personally going to get it. But I think that we have to weigh the pros and the cons for some people, because there are some people that are high risk for having severe disease of COVID, in which case for them, it's likely going to be a better idea to get the vaccine. There's some people we were talking about before that we don't know enough about whether you're pregnant, you know, whether you have an autoimmune condition, breastfeeding. There's some unknowns that we don't know if there's going to be consequences with the vaccine. In which case you really need to talk to your doctor to say, okay, what's the best thing for me in that, because of I'm in one of these categories.
Yeah, it's great. I'd love to work through that a little bit with you and kind of dig into some of the layers. And I always want people to share their honest opinions about it. You know, just the fact that you're like, I'm going to get the vaccine. When you were looking through, and again, when you were doing your own research as a doctor and pulling through for where you are, I saw Terry Walls, right? She's been on the podcast before. She does a bunch of research in the world of functional medicine when it comes to multiple sclerosis, MS. She was once banned by the National MS Society.
Yeah.
And then they gave her a grant for $1 million because her work is so profound. She really is a top-notch researcher and doctor and clinician. She was just writing on there that this beautiful Facebook post, we'll link to it in the comments. She said, I want to talk about the vaccines. And I want to help you understand that I am choosing to get the vaccine because even though I do have areas being somebody who has progressive MS, like this very, you know, MS is already challenging and she has a type that's even more challenging. She has these debilitating shooting sort of pain that goes up her nerves and gives her these crazy headaches that they happen, but way less frequently since she's changed her lifestyle. She was saying that if I want to continue my research, especially the work that's done in person, and she's doing a ton of research in the space of MS, I have to get the vaccine. So I balanced it out and I talked about it with my doctors that even though I feel that my body is frail, I don't know if she used that exact word, but that was basically what she was talking about, I have decided to get it because the research is very important. I want to be able to continue to do the research. What I'm telling a lot of my patients that are autoimmune and have MS or other things is that exactly what you said, talk to your doctor.
Yeah.
Look at that, have that conversation that's there. And I think the thing that functional medicine can bring into the conversation of vaccines that isn't happening is that there are a lot of people that might be in the category of frail who functional medicine sees them that way, but traditional Western medicine may not see them that way. Perfect example is, let's say somebody's fighting, you know, they're really dealing with mold issues and they finally have gotten clear that mold is a big thing for them. mold sometimes can take months to years to be able to work through. And in the meantime, while you're dealing with it, it can make your body, even if you grew up very healthy, you can be in a very frail situation. Another example could be Lyme disease. Mm-hmm. Another example could be that somebody might have just really bad genes and their SNPs and what they're dealing with, that it puts them in a place where they don't detoxify as well. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's the first thing that I want people to understand, is that functional medicine is bringing something unique to the table, which is expanding the idea of what frail is, so that people can understand if they're in that category as they balance out, you know, the pros and cons of getting any medical intervention, let alone the COVID-19 vaccine.
Yeah. And I mean, for that same subgroup of people that you just described, we also have to say, okay, would you rather get COVID or would you rather get the COVID vaccine? Because there's still going to be a lot of, you know, things that you want to think about if you are immunocompromised, or if you have, or if you're frail, you know, however we want to categorize that. Getting COVID itself may be more problematic than getting the vaccine.
And so just to interject there, this is the challenge with a lot of the data when people actually dig in, and I completely, you know, recognize that. There's a gentleman, I've quoted him a few times, his name is Peter Doshi. He's a doctor of pharmacy, pharmacology, also I believe has a background in public health. He's at University of Maryland. He's written some really great articles for the British Medical Journal. And his thing is that, I mean, he's very much not against the vaccine. He's like trying to make that super clear, just like I'm not against the vaccine, neither is Dr. Hyman. Mm-hmm. We look at all medical interventions just exactly for they are, and want to make sure that people want to be pursuing them in a safe manner. And by the way, for everybody that thinks I'm a doctor just because I'm Indian, I'm not a doctor. So take everything that I say with a grain of salt. Listen to Mary, but don't listen to me. But what they were saying, at least early on, because the vaccine trials happened so quickly, we didn't actually know the answer to the question of, are you less likely to get COVID if you got the vaccine? Up until yesterday, they were leaning towards the answer, we don't know. Mm-hmm. Finally, Pfizer came out with some additional data, which was celebrated in the medical community, that it does seem that getting the vaccine makes you less likely to spread the vaccine further to other people. But they do say, and they are telling people, that you still have to do all the safety measures and everything like that, because we're unsure just because of how fast everything happened. So that's where I think that some people like me, you know, people ask me, am I going to get the vaccine, right? Mm-hmm. I'm actually genuinely 0% worried about COVID. I do expect that I would get it at some point in time. And I'm being so cautious. I'm more concerned about giving COVID to somebody, right? That's more of my concern. Mm-hmm. 23andMe has a great calculator online. And there's a bunch of these that are out there, but I did mine the other day. It's like, what's your risk of hospitalization from COVID? Mm-hmm. And you put it in based on your genetics and everything. They already have all that. And then actually, I don't think it's genetics. You can do it even if you aren't a 23andMe customer. You put in your age, weight, you know, background, comorbidities, everything like that. And my risk of hospitalization was like 2-5%. Mm-hmm. On top of that, add everything that I do that's healthy living, exercise, all the stuff that you do. I am genuinely not worried about severe COVID, but I would be worried about giving it to other people. Yeah. If somebody told me that the vaccine is going to be extremely effective at me not transmitting it, I'm much more open to wanting to get it, because I have parents. I do see them pretty frequently. I'm doing all of the things that we know that minimize their risk of COVID, but I wouldn't want to be giving COVID to anybody. So I'm not rushing to get the vaccine. I'm lucky that we're here in California. I don't want to say lucky because it's unfortunate. The state is very behind on getting vaccines
very
to people.
Yes.
So let other people get it who need it more than me. I'm also not worried about short-term side effects, right? I have had both my brother-in-laws are healthcare workers. One is a cardiologist. Another one is about to be a nurse. They've had to get the vaccine because of being in a healthcare setting. You know, they had mild reactions, and most symptoms are going to be mild, and then you're back to normal.
Yep.
So I'm not worried about that aspect of it, but I'm not rushing to get the vaccine.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's it's a good place to be at. I think, you know, part of the discussion is not about us as individuals. It's like you said, whether we're going to transmit to other people too. So as a healthcare professional, you know, I want to make sure that I'm doing the best I can for my patients and not just my individual health. And then the whole thing with the vaccine is, if it's going to, you know, work or be a part of what works in terms of controlling the pandemic, is that about 90% of the population has to get vaccinated to actually get us to that point of, you know, being more of a herd immunity that we can see. So there's a piece of this which is tough. It's not all about our individual health. It's also about the health of the collective, which you touched upon.
Absolutely. And, you know, the nuances are all in. That's why, like, some of the, this gentleman, Peter Doshi, and a few people that I've mentioned before, I for sure agree with those as like top line kind of components. You know, mm-hmm. Dr. Fauci originally said he'd like to see about 60 to 70%. And then the one challenge that I definitely have, and a few other people that are very pro-vaccine, mm-hmm. like people who are very much in the pro-vaccine camp and want everybody to get it, that they've also expressed is that there does seem to be, so basically that 90% number, that's a new number. It came more recently, that number was changed from Fauci when originally the number was 60 to 70%. Okay. And when people were asking him, there was a New York Times interview and a few other people, he replied very honestly that I was looking at the surveys that are out there, and as the vaccine data started coming out, more people started feeling comfortable with the vaccine, so we raised the number.
Mm.
The challenge that I have with that is that it feels that a lot of the pandemic approach has been a little bit of sort of, we are going to be the people, we always say follow the science, and yes, we want to follow the science that's out there, but some of the stuff is really interpretation, when really, if we were following the science, there are actually cheaper, quicker solutions that are out there to control the pandemic. And one of the ones that I really got a chance to go into a little bit more in detail is there's a gentleman named Michael Minna. He's from Harvard University, and he was an original early advocate around rapid at-home antigen testing. Mm. Even though it's not perfect, it's not as, you know, perfect as PCR testing, and PCR testing is not perfect either. My brother-in-law, to just go on a quick tangent, he got COVID, and he's a cardiologist, and his mother passed away. And even though he lives healthy and everything like that, his mom passed away, and he was flying back from there, and, you know, just a lot of stress he was going through, got, you know, COVID in that period of time, and did the whole isolation, you know, went through it. It was pretty mild for him. But then, you know, the hospital told him, like, look, if you retest for COVID, you might still show up as positive because the PCR test doesn't distinguish between dead, quote unquote, virus and live virus. So none of it's perfect. Everybody's doing the best they can. But with the antigen testing, these at-home antigen testing strips cost like between like 50 cents to a dollar to make. And you could buy a bunch of them. And actually every day people could test themselves before they went out and see, do I have COVID and do I need to isolate or do I not? And the cost to do that nationwide, Michael Minna has put some forecasts together, so I don't want to quote it. You can go follow him on Twitter, and you can go on Harvard, and you can go on his Harvard public page, and he has a link to a whole website he's designed. It actually would have more closely gotten us to a place of herd immunity than the vaccine intervention, because every day people would have known if they had COVID or not, and then being able to make the decision of, do I go out there or do I decide not to go out there inside of the world? And when he was asked why, you know, as a public health specialist, as a doctor, why isn't the FDA talking about things like these rapid tests, which are much cheaper solutions? He's like, it's complicated because the FDA sees these antigen tests at home as sort of a medical device, but they don't want people having a medical device without, let's say, a doctor, right? And just like all human beings, we want big fixes. Mm. We want the moonshot. We want to get the thing that is, even if it costs billions of dollars, is the more expensive solution than the cheaper, quicker fixes that actually would save a lot of money. So what I want to just add into that is that, like we started off the conversation, it's a little nuanced.
Yeah.
And yes, we need to get there, but there could have been much faster ways and cheaper ways to get there too.
Yeah. And there's still talk of those being like at CVS, you know, because we have medical devices that we use at home all the time, like pregnancy tests. And, you know, there's all these things.
And it's worked similar to a pregnancy test.
Totally. So we'll probably end up seeing them on the shelves at CVS. Why they're not there already, I don't know. But
just like we are having a very nuanced conversation when it comes to the Black and African-American community in America, you know, they have a much higher rate of vaccine hesitancy than, let's say, people from other ethnic minorities. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is based on the history of vaccines, right? And whether it's experiments like Tuskegee experiment or other stuff, there is just cause for them to have hesitancy, but also to then go through education, which is why there are a lot of public outreach and education campaigns that are there. But nobody's saying, oh, just tell all the Black people to go get vaccinated and just stop making this a big issue. No, we're seeing that for what it actually is. I have a lot of friends in that population and they're sharing their individual concerns and they're balancing it out. And I'm telling them the same thing. Go talk to your doctor that you care about. You know, these are the things that you have to weigh out. But nobody would write that off as disingenuous, for example, with concerns inside of the Black and African-American community and some in the Latinx population too. So I also want to acknowledge people who have concerns who are listening. Like, it's okay to have concerns about long-term implications on the vaccine, and it doesn't mean that you're wearing a tinfoil hat.
No.
Because you're actually just looking at things and saying, this is new, just like any other medical intervention, and you're balancing out your own risk of getting COVID and giving COVID to other people with the data that's available on the vaccine. Mm-hmm. And there's actually a really great op-ed in the New York Times by also this gentleman, Peter Doshi, where he said, don't pressure the vaccine hesitant. Because when you pressure a community and you put them up against, when you call them conspiracy theorists, when you say you're making a big fuss about nothing, what ends up happening, it's like when you're having a conversation with a friend and you are having a friendly debate and all of a sudden now you're saying you start attacking them.
Yeah.
What are they going to do? They're going to double down on their idea.
Yeah, get defensive.
They're going to get defensive. So if you actually care about public health and you are pro-vaccine, that is a very good op-ed to read. It was part of four op-eds in the New York Times where the really strong argument where Peter Doshi exactly said the same thing is that there is cause for people to have some concern. And let's fight that concern with more transparency, more evidence that's out there, and more data as it comes. And then eventually people's concerns will fall to the wayside as they have more people around them getting the vaccine and more information is available. Well, that was the vaccines topic. Thank you for sharing. So last thing to just conclude it. Have you already gone in for your vaccine or is
Monday?
Monday. Awesome.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
They're hard to get in LA right now.
They are definitely. And there's still a genuine thing of like who should be getting it and prioritization. And it's tough. I really feel for the states and the federal government. It's a lot of stuff to kind of coordinate. And I think one challenge that makes it unique in America compared to other countries is it's all county to county based. Yeah. So it's not being led by the state, I guess that has advantages and has disadvantages that are there.
Yeah.
But my parents went in and they got it the other day. They decided to get it again, weighing their risk and everything else like that. They went in, no reactions, no symptoms at all whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And for them, prior to getting it, in addition to all the things that we're doing to balance out their blood sugar and everything else, we definitely upped up the vitamin C, vitamin D, made sure they were on everything. They had no side effects at all whatsoever. So knock on wood that it stays that way, because I would be a little bit more worried for people in their category 70 plus if they would get, you know, a stronger reaction, but they didn't get any. And I'm super thankful for that.
Good.
That's anything that you'll do before you get the vaccine, or you just live your normal life because you're super dialed in and you're married and you're working out all day and you take all your supplements every single day?
Yeah, probably nothing crazy. Definitely just my same routine, which I feel like is, you know, immune supportive as it is. But yeah, vitamin D and sleep and meditation and rest.
Yeah. Well, let's pivot a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about gut health. And I want to go from the topic that we were in before to gut health, because really gut health is actually your immune system.
Yeah.
We've talked about it a little bit before, but for anybody that needs a rehasher on that, what's the gut health immune system link?
Yeah. So the majority of your immune system resides in, like, around the gut. It's called the GALT, the gut associated lymphoid tissue. And this is just a collection of immune cells that we have that interact with our gut and what's inside of our gut. So your gut is actually on the outside of your body, which people don't realize. But just like your skin is on the outside of your body, the the gastrointestinal tube is a tube that runs from your mouth all the way down to your anus. And so it's actually the exterior of your body, which is really important for the immune system because that's one of the places where pathogens will contact our body first. Just like if something landed on our skin, if something goes through our GI tract, then it's going to be in contact with that lining. And the lining is one cell thick. So it's a very thin lining for the GI tract. And on the other side of that cell is the GALT. So some of your lymphocytes and immune cells that are first responders in the immune system. And so there was a connection too between COVID and the gut-associated lymphoid tissue because of the receptors, the ACE receptors that are found in the GI tract, also in the lungs, but also in the GI tract, which is why one of the symptoms sometimes with COVID is actually diarrhea. But having that much tissue that's immune right around the gut means that we have to view your GI tract not just for digesting food and absorbing nutrients, but also as a protective way to keep pathogens out when you have a healthy gut. And so there's a lot of things that go into that, but we talk about intestinal permeability or leaky gut in functional medicine a lot, and that has a role in terms of making sure that you have an really strong gut wall so you don't have the permeability to allow antigens through that shouldn't be getting through.
You know, sometimes when people hear about gut health, this is kind of connecting this topic to our first topic we went into, emotional stress. And they hear about it from a functional medicine and naturopathic perspective. It can feel like very like clear. Do this, start with this, start with that. And yes, that is the case for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure you've also had people that do everything kind of there. And the first topic that we were talking about, which is stress and emotions, they haven't dealt with that. And that still will F up their gut.
Yeah. And I would say that's 90% of the people that come to me. So usually they've seen
other doctors,
5 to 10 other doctors before they've seen me. I've worked in a conventional GI office, and that can be, it's actually a little bit more fun because I'm like the first doctor they've come to see.
Yeah, so you can give them the quick and easy, do the elimination diet, take a couple enzymes,
exactly.
Probiotics, and they feel like night and day difference.
Exactly, yeah. But then you have the people that have been to 5, 10, they've even been to functional medicine doctors, they've been to acupuncturists, they've been to chiropractors, they've gone through everything, and they still have, you know, alternating diarrhea, constipation, bloating, and it's like, now what? And those are the people where I am really digging into, you know, when did this start? I was talking to a young gentleman the other day, and it started when he moved in with his mother. You know, there was a divorce, and that's when the gut issues started. You can't ignore that. Like, if there's a divorce, or if there is a stressor, if there's a death, or anything that's really traumatic that happens, and that's the onset of your gut symptoms, that's not a coincidence. And so really diving into what emotions are around that. Like, what do you actually feel when that's brought up? What happens when you go back to your mom's house? You know, do you have tension that you hold in your gut? A lot of the times when I'm meeting with somebody, I'll say, let's do like a body scan. And when we get to the gut, like, are you contracting your abs? Are you holding things in? And almost all the time people say yes.
It's interesting that you say the contraction of the abs, because when we look at it from a physiological standpoint, when do you typically contract your abs? It's usually when you are bracing for impact.
Yeah.
Right?
And that's what we're doing all day long when we're under stress. We're bracing for impact, but the impact never comes because there's no physical threat, but our brains think otherwise.
Totally. Even just being an entrepreneur, I knew for a long time, and it still happens every so often, when I'm in a situation where, let's say, I feel like I have to, quote unquote, perform, like mm-hmm. I'm about to do a podcast or I'm gearing up for something, the initial sort of tension coming in because you're balancing everything out and you're getting ready to like turn the switch on is I might clench my abs. And so I'm bracing again for an emotional impact that's about to start because you don't know what's there. It reminds me of a story. I had a buddy in San Diego who had a very successful business, had seen a bunch of different doctors, including some doctors at the Ultra Wellness Center, mm-hmm. our clinic, and was not getting better with these issues. And he had some gut issues and some other health issues there. And then finally, I don't know how he arrived at that, but finally said, if I'm serious about getting better, and he was really bad, was suffering with a few things, I actually need to sell my company and get out of the day-to-day.
Yeah.
And it was a big decision. And I didn't even know exactly when he decided to do that, but he sold his company. And I texted him a few months later on and I said, hey, brother, I'm just thinking about you. How are you doing? He's like, I've never been better. Mm. And I didn't realize how much my issues were tied into stress. Not that there aren't other things. Yeah, I think he was working through some Lyme stuff, some other things that needed to be addressed. But there's this kind of core idea that a lot of functional medicine doctors are talking about, which is if your body is already, if your immune system is so suppressed through just general life stress of managing the day-to-day work, family, et cetera, it may not be able to get to a place where it can actually start the full healing process because it's almost like it needs to get to 20% to hit that threshold and it can never make it past 10%.
Yeah, I see this all the time. And I think it's not until we take away that stressor like your friend did till you actually see how much of an impact it has on your health. But you know, when people come to me and they're like, I have mold, I was told by this doctor I have mold, I have heavy metals, I have, you know, all of this stuff. If there's multiple things going on like that and it's been chronic, meaning it's not just an acute thing, I'm always wondering, why can't your body detoxify? Why is your immune system not where it should be to actually get rid of that mold? And sure, there's genetic mutations that increase or decrease your ability to detoxify. But I truly believe that our bodies have the innate ability to heal themselves. And so if they're not going through that process, then what is actually lowering your immune function? What's making it so that you can't detoxify properly? And a lot of that, when we look at chronic health conditions, is going to be the mental, emotional, spiritual stress piece of it. You know, are you living a life that you don't like waking up in the morning? You don't like the job that you're going to. You don't, you don't have a healthy relationship with your partner. All of these things are going to change how your immune system functions, and it's going to make you at an increased risk for getting a mold infection or not being able to detoxify heavy metals in your body, or having continuous SIBO symptoms that keep flaring up because you don't have any motility because you're living in the fight or flight. But we have to figure out like what is that underlying thing. And for your friend, it's like, you know, selling his company let up enough of that stress where his body could start to heal itself and the immune system could start again. But you really have to figure out what that piece is that's missing.
It's so true. Cause even on a, it sometimes can seem so ethereal, but on a biological level, I was reading that, and I got this from Dr. Leaf, because I was doing an interview with Dr. Caroline Leaf for her new book. And she was writing that basically the pancreas, when you're stressed and sort of in that mode of fight or flight or whatever you're dealing with, even freeze, she had thrown out a number. I think it was like the pancreas is like, can be 40% like more inefficient. And the pancreas, which is secreting all these enzymes, which help you process and digest food. Now you're eating food, you're stressed, or you're looking at Instagram, thinking about everything that you don't have, comparing yourself to other people while you're trying to eat at the same time. Now you can't digest at the same time. You can't digest, which means you're going to get 40% less nutrients from all the food that you're eating, which means that other mechanisms are not going to happen. So it's not ethereal. It's actually happening on a cellular and a DNA level.
Totally. That brings us to mindful eating, which is the opposite of stressful eating.
Tell me, how are you doing that? Like, talk about mindful eating, but also talk about like, how are you doing that right now at home and also fighting against sort of the distractions that, you know, is watching TV while eating, is that a completely bad thing? Can you still be mindful eating while doing that? Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear.
Yeah. First of all, I'm human. I'm not perfect, so I don't mind.
I thought you were perfect.
I am not.
That's why this podcast title was called How to Do Everything Perfect with Dr. Mary.
But yeah, the majority of the time you want, especially if you have gut issues, this is the first place I would start. Like this costs
First.
This costs no money. I've had people, it's because it's in my gut health course, but I've had people just do this and solve like IBS issues that they've had for years. So I've had amazing emails that have been sent just about the impact that mindful eating can have if you go all into it. But the quote that you said, so about 30% of your pancreatic enzymes and about 20% of your stomach acid are produced during the cephalic phase of digestion. So cephalic is a Latin word, comes from the root head. So that means the sight, smell, taste, even the sound, right, of the food that we're preparing. So this is before the food actually hits your mouth and then right when the food hits your mouth for the taste. But it's actually the preparation of food. And humans have been around for 200,000 years, right? Fast food, prepared foods have been around for 100 years. And so as humans, we're not evolved to go have...
Barely 100 years.
Barely.
Even.
Totally, yeah. Barely. We're not evolved to go and just have a hamburger and eat it. There should have been a whole process of, you know, cutting up the meat, cooking it, having that time where like the aroma is actually coming into your nose, chopping the vegetables, looking at them, cooking them. The preparation phase of food is extremely important to the digestive process. And we're lacking a lot of that when we're doing prepared foods, which the majority of us are.
Especially when we're doing Uber Eats.
Uber Eats.
Is there a hack? Is there a hack when you order in? Is it to bring up a photo of a food and kind of like look at it a little bit until you start salivating?
There's a word for that, right?
Food porn?
Food porn. That might be a new business idea. Cephalic phase. There is a little bit of a hack of it because you can still stimulate that cephalic phase if before you eat your meal, you put it in front of you, you look at it, you smell it, you sit with it. It's a great time to do gratitude as well. Mm. Think of things that you're grateful for. Also, sharing a meal with somebody else slows you down, so you could have a conversation while you're looking at your food. It's a really important time to kind of savor the moment and the power of now, Eckhart Tolle, to be in the present state, right? To really just be there with your food. Sounds like a love story, but it is.
It is. I mean, we should love our food and all the things that go into, especially if you're, you know, eating meat, just the sacrifice that went into it, the farmers that all had a hand into it.
The appreciation of growing the food.
The fact that we even have food, you know, there's so many times where it's like that, even that we have food when there's so many people that don't have food.
Yeah.
It should be a full-on gratitude thing.
It should be. And then from there, so after you've visualized, smelled, then it comes, you start to eat. And the tasting of the food, to really savor that, to slow down. Most people will consume their entire meal in minutes. And so you really want to slow down that entire process so that your body has the time to produce those digestive enzymes and the stomach acid. Chewing your food is extremely important, and people miss out on this process. Men specifically tend to shovel in their food, but women do as well. And so you want to not swallow your food until it's baby food consistency. So it should be pureed by the time it goes into your stomach. The reason behind that is the only mechanical digestion that we actually have is our teeth. So after the food leaves our mouth, we only have chemical digestion left, which is from the stomach acid and the pancreatic enzymes that we produce when we're in the parasympathetic, the rest and digest state. So you really want to make sure it's baby food, you swallow it, and then you also want to make sure that you're not doing things. So just what you are doing is just as important as what you're not doing. Watching television, working, doing emails while you're eating is going to take you out of the parasympathetic, put you into the sympathetic fight or flight state where your digestive system isn't moving. Motility is a huge issue when it comes to the most common GI conditions. Reflux, IBS.
Even if you're watching something uplifting that's not sort of like freaking you out, even if you're watching something like informative.
There's a statistic.
Yeah, tell me about
it. There's a statistic.
I'll be honest, I do usually at night, not during the day.
Yeah.
It's sort of one of the ways because my fiance, we sort of bond over, this has been a COVID thing because we didn't used to do it beforehand, but we don't like any of the same stuff in terms of like watching. Mm-hmm. But there's a few things that we do like, and they might be a show about business or like an inspirational documentary. We especially are big fans of like documentaries about music producers like Clive Davis. And we sort of sit and we would watch that together, not every night. And so I'm definitely guilty of that. So I want to know the stat.
Yeah. There was a research study done that looked at people who eat food while watching TV or working. They lumped them into the same category. So maybe you're positive
uplifting. I think working is got to say that working was probably the cause of all the bad stats.
So the people that were doing something while they were eating and they weren't just sitting with their food and eating weighed 18% more than the people that weren't doing something while they were eating. And so 18% more, what the heck does that mean? It feels very, you know, just an idea. 150-pound person, it's 27 extra pounds. Mm-hmm. Significant.
Got it.
Very significant. You could do a study on yourself and see, but I think the point is with that, even if it is something uplifting, you're distracting yourself from your meal. And you really want to be present with your meal to actually sense, when are you 80% full? Like, when are you getting to the point where I'm not hungry anymore? Which is really when we should stop eating and see if we should have more food or if we shouldn't. So if you're, you know, especially if weight loss is top priority, then really being just present with your food and just another human being so you know when to stop.
Yeah, I definitely agree with the working thing and kind of multitasking. You're kind of in one mode and you're doing another thing, mm-hmm. or even just looking at the phone, mm-hmm. especially when it comes to the things on social media by design are the most popular stuff. The most popular stuff tends to be not always what's good for you. It's just stuff that is popular. So, yeah. You know, this quote that I've shared a bunch of times with our community, but it's from Reverend Michael Beckwith. He says, like, the news is a collection of the lowest common denominator of humanity. Mm-hmm. And sometimes social media can be that too. Mm-hmm. So you're just seeing things that are keeping you distracted to kind of feed that mind input instead of taking a fast. And I can definitely see it on that side. But you know what? I'm going to try it again. Not that me and my partner don't ever just sit between us, but I think we got into a little bit of a habit with COVID and not entertaining as much and not going out as much where we're relying on that. But you said something really interesting, which was this is one of your top go-tos, like mm-hmm. an easy go-to, something that anybody can do and it doesn't cost you anything. What else is close on that category? If you put your top five things for gut health, inexpensive to, you know, not inexpensive to cheap, what else would be in that category if you had a couple more to add?
Absolutely. Walking is free.
And walking, like, right after a meal.
Right after a meal and just during the day in general. But yeah, between meals is really good because you're actually stimulating that rest and digest, the parasympathetic. So walking will stimulate the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve innervates from the mouth to the lower part of the colon to help with motility, to make sure things are moving. But also when you stimulate that parasympathetic, the vagus nerve, you're also stimulating digestive enzymes, secretions. You're stimulating the whole GI tract in its entirety. Walking is also great for so many other health reasons, reducing the risk for cardiovascular disease, diabetes, I mean, a whole host of things for movement. And movement is really different from exercise too. So I put them in different categories, but I'm talking about passive movements that you do during the day. So walking is right up there with the top five things that I would do for gut health.
Growing up, my grandparents on both sides would walk after every meal. And I used to feel like, what the hell is going on? Yeah. You know, like, you're younger and like, why are we different? Why do we have to all go around the neighborhood? We would literally would make a loop.
That's so cute.
We'd make a loop out of with my grandparents. We'd always make a loop. My dad's grandparents especially were super into it. And they were like more into like Ayurveda and stuff. But it was a thing. They were like, you eat and you walk. Mm-hmm. More recently, there's a buddy of ours, shout out to Mohit, who really kind of got our, you know, guys crew that all hangs out together. And every Thursday we have this man morning hike that I just went this morning. He really got our group, we've hung out as a group, as a, like our own little bubble during COVID. He really got our group into, like, we'd go out to a restaurant in LA, let's say when outdoor dining was open, we'd all eat. And he would say, let's just like walk around the block.
Love it.
And it was like, let's do it. Yeah. So I went to Austin with another buddy of mine, Nirav, who you know, and we all had dinner at his house. And then right after he's like, let's go around and walk around the neighborhood. I was like, this is perfect. Like, goes back to the classic example of like your grandparents were probably right.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of traditional things that we just do and don't know why we do them. But walking after a meal, you know, it reduces your blood sugar. I've got people on the Dexcom, the continuous glucose monitors. And that's one of the things that I'll do if their blood sugars will remain elevated after a meal is just have them go for a walk. It's a way to get sugars into your cells independently of glucose. So your muscle cells actually act like a sponge when you're moving, like a pump. So you're actually like pushing things in there mechanically versus just relying on insulin.
Speaking about CGM, do you use one?
Yeah. I've used the Dexcom on myself. I use it with patients too.
We got to get you to try this new one, Levels. because they've written this software. Mm-hmm. I've used Dexcom before too. And it's great and you can kind of see, but it's really up to you as a user to try to piece all the data together. Mm-hmm. Levels, and we had Casey, the founder of it, on the podcast previously. They have written this software, former, I think, Airbnb and Apple guys. They've been at a few of the, you know, big tech companies. Mm-hmm. They write the software that basically does all the interpretation for you. And if you want to, you take a photo of what you ate after the meal and it'll rank it on a scale of 1 to 10 in terms of its response for your blood sugar. 10 is like, great, this is a great meal. And if you see a lot that are in like the 2s and the 3s, you're like, wow, okay, great. Maybe I shouldn't eat 6 tortilla wraps at the same time, even if they're gluten-free, that's going to spike my blood sugar. So I learned so much of dialing into what works for me personally through using it. So I'm going to get them to set you up. It's actually really cool.
That's amazing. Yeah, it's fun. It's really fun to piece through that data and just see, like, you personally, what spikes your blood sugar. For me, oatmeal was like terrible. Oatmeal was my it was more so than ice cream. So I had ice cream one day and then I had oatmeal the other day and very small amounts of both. So it's not like I had this huge bowl of oatmeal and a tiny thing of ice cream, but ice cream was pretty much insignificant, but the oatmeal with just a couple berries on it, huge spike.
Crazy. Mm-hmm. And then they've talked about that a little bit because Casey, again, the founder, she is, she's an MD, she's vegan. So she's always trying to help people figure out, right? Because like vegans eat a lot of oatmeal, quinoa, other stuff. She's like, here's all the hacks of how you can bring that down. Add in a bunch of nuts, add in some fats that are there that are, you know, separate from, add in, you know, these components to all help sort of mitigate. But yes, I didn't try oatmeal, but oat milk. Oat milk, which interestingly, if you look at like the back of like Oatly, like that's the most popular one that's out there. And a lot of people switch from like almonds and kind of coconut because they feel like I have so much almond and coconut milk in my diet. I want to switch to oat and mix it up. But oat milk actually made me, when I had unsweetened almond milk and I had unsweetened oat milk, interestingly, in the fermentation or however they make it process, they have to add sugar early on. So even though there's no added sugar, there's sugar in that process, oat milk made me spike more than almond milk. And that kind of threw me off more than anything else. And also, I love the company and I just want to say it because shout out to them for amazing family business and what they've built. I think they're based in Texas, Siete, and the Siete chips and the wraps, I think they're incredible and I love the company and I always recommend them. But I ate a little bit too much. Like let's say I would have, you know, I know now I can only have like 1 to 2 tortilla wraps. If I have like 4 to 6, my blood sugar, even though it's gluten-free, even though it's healthy, my blood sugar is going through the roof.
Yeah. Sometimes the gluten-free options actually will spike you more than the gluten-full options because they have to have more ingredients. The tapioca can be a spiker too. That's really
absolutely
included.
Cassava, tapioca, all these things can have even sometimes more of an impact on the blood sugar, which is why I'm super bullish on the whole CGM space. And I'm excited for more people to get access to it. Was there anything else on, so walking?
Walking.
Mindful eating.
Mindful eating.
Is there any sort of favorite product or a go-to right now or anything that you recommend for your patients that is in that top 5 for gut health?
Yes. Well, first, elimination diet.
Elimination diet. If people haven't done it before.
If you haven't done it before, also, I have a post on my Instagram, but I do a specific one with gut people. So if it's like reflux, bloating, constipation, diarrhea, if your issues are gut related, meaning like it's not just a rash that you're trying to get rid of, for the elimination diet, you also want to make sure that you take out nuts. And that's not usually, sometimes it's in an elimination diet, but it's not always. But nuts are going to be a huge one. Nuts, nut butters, because of the fiber content, can really cause a lot of bloating and worsen constipation for some people with gut health issues.
Especially in the modern day health world where we're eating just
so
a
many
ton
more
of
nuts. Yeah.
Nuts typically actually, depending on region, would be very seasonal. They would come in like the winter time, and then you may not have access to them year out.
Yeah.
For good or for worse, we have access to like as much as we want and everything has nuts inside of it.
Everything has nuts inside of it. And also if you figure out how many nuts you would need to get like a tablespoon or two of almond butter, it's way more than you could ever gather on your own on a daily basis,
at one point in time.
you're just not going to do it. So really looking at it from a quantity standpoint, but that's one of the things that I would take away.
Yeah. And I've dabbled a little bit in elimination diets. For me, the biggest thing on the gut side for bloating, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about bloating. When I greatly minimized grains in my diet, especially because I grew up and I was on a lot of antibiotics for like strep throat and other stuff, like I decimated my gut. This is back in the day. I'm not that old, but I'm almost 40. Back in the day where there was like no real consideration of like antibiotics and just kind of throwing it in for whatever it might be. Even sometimes when it wasn't bacterial and it was more viral, they would just give the family something. Obviously, a lot of that has changed, but I decimated my gut with antibiotics and I cannot really handle a lot of quinoa, brown rice, white rice. Actually, I do okay with. I don't need a ton of it, but I do okay with it. And also, I can't do the whole lentils and beans thing unless if it's like my mom's making it in a pressure cooker type thing. And even then, if I eat a ton, I'm bloated as a mofo.
Yeah. And the legumes and beans bloating is universal for most people. So some people will digest them better, but a lot of people will get bloated from beans and legumes. So those are one things that we take out in the elimination diet for gut health too.
Yeah, and it's not to be sort of hyper focused on individual foods and other things. I actually think that there's a lot of benefit to not having like very restrictive diets. It's just that when you're suffering, you'll try stuff. So I think I'd love to link to that Instagram post. And I always recommend people that if they are going to go down a lot of sort of elimination diets, because you see some people who are like, I can only eat this, this, and this.
Right.
That's not the long-term answer.
No.
The body was meant to eat a lot of different things.
Yeah.
And in some extreme cases, people could end up with some version of an eating disorder.
Yeah. Orthorexia.
Orthorexia or some other component. I do want to add that in because I haven't always added that in the past talking about elimination diet and what I've done. I've never had an eating disorder, so I'm not as present to it as maybe somebody like yourself. But I did hear from some listeners saying, look, if you're going to talk about elimination diet, you really do have to acknowledge that extreme elimination diet, which is more common. But in that instance, that person really should be working with a doctor to really figure out what are the root issues that prevent them from eating a lot of different types of foods.
Yeah. And an elimination diet should be a trial of between 21 and 30 days. So it should not be 9 months to a year, right? That's not an elimination diet. That's more the new way that you're eating. So it's really important that you take out the foods and put them back in and see, because it may just be that one food for you that you can't tolerate. And then you work on your health with your practitioner, and then maybe you can even put that one food back in. But I think it's, yeah, it's exactly what you said. It's really, really important to not maintain a restrictive eating pattern for too long, because then there develops the fear of food. And in my mind, the fear of food is just as bad or worse than the actual gut health issue that you started with from the beginning.
And in some cases, you actually also can lose bacterial strains because you don't have as much diversity.
Yeah, diversity is king when it comes to the microbiome. And so if you're not eating a range of different vegetables, range of different foods, then you're much more likely to decrease your microbial diversity, which is where we get all of the short-chain fatty acids, those things that help protect our gut lining, like butyrate, that are anti-inflammatory as well, and protect against intestinal permeability, which we touched upon before.
Fiber. How much fiber are you actually eating in a day? And, you know, there's all these different thoughts about it. I feel like I do best when I get a lot of fiber that works for me. We, you know, again, going back to Terry Walls, we've had her on the podcast for MS patients and other stuff, people who are really having gut motility issues because MS and autoimmune things are linked to the gut. She's like nine cups of fiber a day.
And I think that's what you work up to. So our average American consumes 15 grams of fiber per day. RDA for the US recommends 25, 30 grams of fiber per day. Our ancestors, hunter-gatherer tribes, ate 150 grams of fiber per day. So average American 15, hunter-gatherers 150, tenfold difference there.
Do you know how many grams that might be equivalent in cups, 150 grams? Like,
it's going to depend on, you know,
what fiber it is and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and if it's cooked, if it's not cooked, so many different things. But it's a lot. You're definitely looking at the 9, 10 plus cup range for sure. And so that just shows you that we are evolved to eat fiber 100%. If you start eating 150 grams of fiber tomorrow and you're eating 15 today, you're going to be not so happy because you're going to feel a lot of GI distress. You'll get bloating. So with fiber, you have to go slow. So start low, go slow, but increase gradually. So if you're having 2 cups of vegetables today, 3 tomorrow. Try that for a few days and increase to 4. So just go slowly. But I think that the more fiber that we can consume and feel good with, the better it is for our gut microbiome.
In kind of the early days of keto, when a lot of our like peer group and other stuff was doing it, I also started, I went keto and was including more meat than I normally do.
Yeah.
And about 3-4 months into it, I didn't even realize it, which is crazy because I've always had a lot of fiber in my diet, except for when I was really young and eating a processed vegetarian diet of Cheetos. Do Cheetos have a lot of fiber? I was eating a lot of Cheetos and just like, you know, just anything that wasn't meat. That was my vegetarian diet. My mom did cook at home, which was really nice. So I got a lot of good fiber from the Indian food that she'd make at home. But when I went keto initially and I started including a lot more meat in my diet because that was the way that I did it. You don't need to do it that way. I didn't realize, but I, by accident, in a way, I ended up eating just a lot less fiber than I was eating before. It's very common. I'm sure you see it with people. And about 3-4 months into it, for the first time in my life, I was starting to get a little constipated.
Yeah.
And I was not, I was like, what the hell is going on? Like, I've never get constipated. I always have good gut motility. I have no idea what's going on. And then I was chatting with a friend and they were like, also in the space, and they're like, but how much fiber are you having? I was like, oh, I eat a ton of fiber. And then later on the drive home, I was like, actually, I've significantly cut down the amount of fiber. Mm-hmm. And just simply adding back in the amount of fiber that I normally had with like that big everyday salad that I do, which at least has probably 4 to 5 cups of vegetables in it by itself. Mm-hmm. And then making these breakfast skillets that I would normally do, where I would add in a ton of like sweet potato and, you know, other vegetables and broccolini. In a matter of like a couple days, my constipation went away.
Yeah.
I did have to take a little bit of a probiotic because I needed it at a time as well. But it's just amazing how we forget. We can end up eating a processed wellness diet.
So
thinking
easy.
That we're doing the right thing and we're missing out on something else.
Yeah, so easy. And we've talked about grandparents a few times. Like, it's like bring it back to the basics a lot of the time. So if you're getting caught up in like a fad diet or something, sometimes if you look back at what did my grandparents eat, what did our ancestors eat, that gives a little bit more clarity.
So for you, where are you getting this fiber in and what is your favorite ways for you specifically?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like throughout the day, if you're just looking at like how you're eating and including this in, how are you getting in those, you know, 6 to 10 cups of vegetables
or
fiber?
I love eating bitter foods for my digestion too. So dandelion greens are one of my favorites. I also just love dandelion greens. I think you can get really like hooked on them if you like them. But so sauteed vegetables, cooking your greens and your vegetables in general will reduce the risk of you feeling bloated after a meal because it starts the digestive process just by cooking them. And then I also make a green drink. And it's not a typical like green juice that you would buy at the store, but I put in a bunch of leafy greens. Honestly, it's whatever I have in my fridge. Even if I have like cooked broccoli from the night before, like I'll throw it into my Vitamix. And it's not a plug for Vitamix, but you need something that's going to really blend the veggies up so it becomes a liquid. So I put all the veggies in there with water, some lemon juice, a couple drops of stevia, and I blend it so it's liquefied. And I drink it with the pulp. So I don't want to take out the actual pulp that some people would take out to make a normal green juice. But you want to keep it in there to actually get the fiber that's in there.
Shout out to Vitamix. I mean, I probably have two Vitamixes that I've had for like almost 20 years.
Same. They last. They have that warranty and they last that long for
sure. They really do.
Yeah.
They really do. No, it's excellent. Mary, we've covered a lot of different topics. It was such a hodgepodge, but that's why I wanted you on here, is I wanted to have an interview where we got a chance to dip our toes into a bunch of different things. I always appreciate your opinion and your perspective in the world and how you just keep it real and are always willing to evolve the thinking and chat about sort of what you're doing with your own life in addition to what you're having with patients. Anything that you wanted to talk about that we didn't get a chance to cover?
Man, I feel like we covered a lot.
It's also getting hot in this studio.
I was going to say, it's like a hot yoga class right about now.
We're in a studio in Los Angeles, and the building AC has not been on point. So in the afternoon, it's getting a little hot over here. So I can see both of us fading a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I think the stats are that once the temperature gets above 75, productivity can go down. And obviously, everybody has their own preference. But I can see that if we continue a little bit more longer, we might start slurring our speech, saying some things we don't mean to say. What's going on in your world? Plug a few things that you're up to or want to give attention to and how people can find you.
Absolutely. So I've got my gut health course through Commune.
Which expands on a lot of stuff that we talked about.
Yeah. IBS, SIBO. We talk about inflammatory bowel disease, helminthic therapy, fecal transplants, a lot of cool stuff, but also the basics. I'm doing a mold webinar February 22nd. So we're going to have a bunch of different experts, the mold guys who do a lot of testing.
Totally.
For
I want to get them on the podcast. We've been messaging back and forth.
Yeah. We're going to have them. We're also going to have a professional mold cleaner. So like, do you have to throw away all of your personal belongings if you've had mold in your house, or can you clean some of them, and what machine to make sure that you use to clean those things? And then we're going to have a functional medicine doctor talking about mold toxicity treatment options as well. So that's February 22nd.
I need to listen to that because this building was built in like 1910.
Yeah.
There's definitely mold in
70%
here.
Of the buildings have mold in the US.
I mean, we try to run. We have our air doctor and all the rooms and other things like that. We try to minimize, open the windows as much as we can, which is practical when you can't vacate a space. And we've worked in here for over 2 years. We do see visible signs of mold. So I think we need to get out and go to a different building.
Yeah.
But I think anybody can benefit from that. So that's great. When is that launch?
February 22nd. It's at noon. We're going to do it live. But if you can't make it, it'll get emailed to you as well.
Okay. And where do people go to sign up?
We've got the link that I've show notes.
Yeah. Send it to me. We'll have in the show notes.
Yeah.
So gut course at Commune.
Yep.
Mold webinar.
Mold webinar. And then if you want to work with somebody one-on-one, we now have a team of naturopathic doctors at Modern Med. And we have a team approach at this point. So basically, we meet every week and you have three eyes on your case. And then we go around and collaborate on each case. So that's a great way if you're looking for one-on-one patient care. And that's modernmed.com, no E in modern.
That's great. I know if some of our past listeners have worked with you and
all
have great things to say. And you are taking care of also my future mother-in-law, who has nothing but great things to say about you.
Nothing but wonderful things to say about her.
So, Mary, thank you for all you do. And thanks for being just like a positive force in the world and just putting out great information. Really appreciate you.
Thank you, Drew. I appreciate you.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.